This is episode number 784 of the Secret Identity podcast, and today in What's New, we're going to talk about the Marvel trade collections that are coming out soon to tie into some of their movies, as well as some of the upcoming cons that we're going to be going to. Our comics this week will be Spectacular Spider-Man number 1, Darth Vader number 2, and Magnus Robot Fighter number 1. And the first installment of our summer watching project arrives this week as we revisit the 1995 Judge Dredd movie.
Before we get started, does anyone want to get out?
The Human Torch was denied a bank loan.
This is all your fault, you!
Get that finger out of your ear. You don't know where that finger's been.
Why do you keep staring at me?
20 seconds to comply.
God clean the whole from fun.
And welcome everybody to Secret Identity. This is Brian Letenry here, as always, with the lovely, the talented, the beautiful, the excited to talk about Judge Dredd, Matthew A. Herring. How are you today, sir?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm fantastic. We're both excited to talk about that movie, but we've got other stuff to talk about first, Matthew.
Yes.
First of all, as we mentioned in the last episode, we are now fully into the summer con season.
Yep.
And so as you listen to this in July, we have a couple of shows coming up. The first one, as I grab my notes to remember the dates exactly, on July 29th, we'll be going to Plastic City Comic Con, of course, at the Wallace Civic Center in Fitchburg, Massachusetts, from 10 to 6. Kids 12 and under free, adults only $2, Jerry Ordway, Joe Caramagna, Sean Wong, Chris Gugliotti, Jay May, Kat Cusio, George O'Connor, HB Comics, and more, and us.
And us.
And Keith Gleason.
Yep.
And Amy Kukta, the organizers of this show. I guess I have to say Amy Gleason now.
Or Keith Kukta.
Yes, Keith Kukta. That's how we're going to say it from now on.
I like that better.
A fantastic show, as we mentioned in the last episode, kind of like our summer high school reunion.
Yep, that's exactly what it is.
Our one-day camp that we get to go to. We will be at that show. That show will be a ton of fun. And then, of course, in August, the 18th through the 20th at Mohegan Sun in Uncasville, we'll be going to Terrificon. Mm-hmm. Our good buddy Mitch Halleck has put together another ridiculously amazing show this year. You've got Scott Snyder. You've got Greg Capullo. You've got George Perez. You've got Marv Wolfman. You've got Keith Giffen, J.M. DeMatteis, Kurt Busiek, Stan Sakai, Peter David, Chris Russo, and many more. And that's just for comics.
Mm.
How about Dean Cain? How about Finn Jones? How about Echo Kellum? How about Violet Bean? How about Shannon Purser?
A lot of people. A lot of people.
And the show is dedicated to Adam West, which is really nice as well. And I know there are a couple of Batman 66 stars that are going to be at the show as well. So lots of great stuff coming for cons for us this summer. And we are super excited about that, Matthew. You might be excited about Thor Ragnarok, which is coming out in November, because I know I am.
I am very excited about it.
The trailer for that looks absolutely amazing, and Marvel is going to be pumping out Thor collections ahead of the release of Thor Ragnarok. Now, why I thought this was interesting was because, if I'm not mistaken, neither one of us are big Thor guys.
Nope. Love the movies. Not a big fan of the book.
What was the series that Chris Samnee drew?
That was the Thor God of Thunder.
Was it Thor God of Thunder or Thor the Mighty Avenger?
The Mighty Avenger.
Something like
that.
And
that was a 12-issue series, which you and I both loved that one.
Yes. And then was it Jason Aaron that did Thor for a while?
Yep.
Because I didn't read a ton of his stuff. Then you had the Thor where it was Jane Foster, who I believe is still Thor currently right now, correct?
I'm not sure.
And you have the Thor that we knew as Odinson, who is out doing his own thing. But neither one of us are huge Thor fans.
I like Thor Frog.
You love Thor Frog.
Love
You've made that
Thor
clear
Frog.
Over many, many episodes, over many, many years on this show. But Marvel is putting out Thor trades. So for people who only know Thor through the movies or maybe haven't dug into Thor's history or a lot of that back stuff, the Thor Ragnarok Prelude fills in the gap between Thor the Dark World and the latest entry in the Thor cinematic universe, setting the stage for the major players, Thor, Odin, Loki, and Hulk. So it kind of gives some backstory and kind of fills in that stuff. It has Thor 1966, number 361, Incredible Hulk number 95 from 2000. That will be out October 4th. Marvel's Thor Ragnarok, The Art of the Movie, gives a whole bunch of artwork from the movie. Thor versus Hulk, which is one that I might pick up, collects the greatest clashes between the God of Thunder and the Green Goliath, featuring work for some of the most celebrated creators in comics history, including Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, Roy Thomas, Sal Buscema, and many more. It's 336 pages, and it collects Avengers number 3, Submariner number 35, Defenders number 10, Incredible Hulk 255, and 440, Thor 385 and 489, Hulk number 5 and 6, What If number 45, and material from Journey into Mystery 112, a whole bunch of other stuff, $30 for 336 pages of Thor.
That's a great deal.
Then you've got Thor by Walter Simonson. Collects a whole bunch of his stuff.
And that's the definitive run for a lot of people.
Yep, that's going to have 232 pages, Thor number 337 through 345. That's $25. Thor Gods and Deviants, Thor Ragnaroks, a whole bunch more are all coming at about $25 to $35 a piece. And they're all going to be coming out before Thor Ragnarok opens in theaters November 3rd.
Very good.
So that's pretty exciting. What I was more excited about, though, is Marvel is going to be releasing some horror collections.
Oh.
Prior to Halloween this year. Tomb of Dracula, the complete collection, volume 1. It collects the first 15 issues of Tomb of Dracula and Dracula Lives. It's going to have, that's going to be 512 pages at $40. Jack Russell, a.k.a. Werewolf, Howls in Werewolf by Night, the complete collection, volume 1. That is going to be 432 pages for $40, and Marvel Horror, the magazine collection, assembles some of the best stories from Marvel's vaunted black and white horror magazines. 264 pages from Haunt of Horror, Monsters Unleashed, Bizarre Adventures. That is going to be $35.
That's the one I'm interested in.
So I'm pretty stoked about that because I don't have a lot of Marvel's horror comics. Mm-hmm. I might have a showcase of Dracula.
Yep.
Maybe. But they don't call them showcases. That's DC,
or,
right?
Essentials.
Essentials. I think I have an essential of Dracula. But that's about it. So I am definitely kind of keen to get into to some of that stuff. So Marvel is like busting out huge trade collections right now. And the thing that's cool about the Thor one is like that's what you should be doing around the release of a movie, especially for a character that people might not be totally familiar with all of their backstory and stuff like that. So I feel like that's a – that's sort of a must-have.
Yeah.
And I think that actually, Matthew, is a good segue into our comics for this week because the first comic that we're going to talk about this week, which you and I didn't talk about beforehand but both picked up and both enjoyed, is Peter Parker, The Spectacular Spider-Man number 1. And what Marvel is doing with this series is this is a series that's sort of a back-to-basics Peter Parker, Spider-Man, having adventures in New York sort of a series. While over in the Dan Slott run of Amazing Spider-Man, you've got Parker Industries, you've got sort of an international Spider-Man. There's a lot of stuff going on. There's a lot of longtime storylines that are happening in that book. This one is designed for people who may go to Spider-Man Homecoming and say, hey, I'd like to pick up a Spider-Man book. Well, great news for you. There is a brand new series that just started at number one, and it features a Spider-Man that you don't have a ton of knowledge of in order to be able to pick up and read it.
No, because this is one that you can just pick up and read right off the bat without any – you don't have to have any knowledge of Spider-Man. If you just saw the movies, this will fit in perfectly for you. And my big selling point on this one was having Adam Kubert be the artist. I love Adam.
That's an instant draw for you.
I love Joe. And starting this one off where you get the origin and
– might I just say who is a draw for me? Jordy Belair.
And you can see that with the – three or four different color palettes that Jordy used in this book.
Just the sort of tan, almost bronze-ish golden hour hue of the city.
Yeah.
When in the opening panel, Spidey and Johnny are sharing lunch together is enough for me right there.
And Chip Zdarsky. We cannot mention this great story that he
handed. Chip Zdarsky has been doing some very funny stuff across the Marvel Universe. Did he do the Howard the Duck series?
I think he did that. And did he do Jughead?
He did do some of Jughead. I don't know if he's still on that or not, but he's got a great sense of humor. And so I think that works well for Spider-Man.
And it works well with this where I love when you start out, you have the basic origin. Everybody sort of knows the origin of Spider-Man. And as you're reading this, I remember thinking it going, I kind of know the origin of Spider-Man. And then you turn the page and he's hanging out with Johnny Storm, who Johnny Storm says, why are you telling me your origin?
Right.
I know your origin.
It's like, I got my powers from a rocket adventure. That's like 1,000 times more interesting than what you have.
Yep. And you'd see that until you realize, too, that that's the Human Torch and sort of his
his Inhumans.
Inhumans costume.
Yeah. I was happy to see Human Torch here because it's bittersweet, though.
Yes,
because
it
you
is.
Realize that they're just not doing anything with Fantastic Four, and that is infuriating.
Yep.
But I love there's a few things I love about this book. One is that right out of the gate, you're highlighting the friendship of Spidey.
Which has been.
And Johnny.
Forever.
Yep. Love that.
And you have a couple things in here just within the first few pages that I loved. And this was something that you and I talked about a few episodes ago. There are a ton of editor notes here. Hey, if you didn't already know this, this is going on here.
And lots of deep cuts to yes. old stories. Yes.
Yes. So you have a lot of that. So basically what the two of them decide to do is that they are going to hang out and have movie night together. But they spend 5 panels insulting each other. And then you see that big hug at the end, the bro hug. And it's like, hey, so we're going to get together, right? Don't forget. Oh, and then Spider-Man leaves it with, yeah, I probably won't forget.
Yeah.
Which is very important in the story.
And he, you know, so they're going to meet at 7:30 that night. And so now he's swinging around and he's like, he gets a phone call from Aunt May. Hey, my favorite aunt named May. What's going on, gorgeous? She's like, oh, not much, just keeping busy. And he realizes that, oh, crap, that's right. She just lost her husband.
Yes. Another one.
Because J. Jonah Jameson's father was Aunt May's husband recently in the comics. And I say recently, but that was a storyline that was built over years.
Yes.
And she ended up basically finding another person to fall in love with after many years after the passing of Uncle Ben, and only to have that guy pass away.
Now, how did he die?
I believe that he had some sort of critical medical condition where he was going to die, and that New You Technologies, which was the Jackal, mm-hmm. offered to basically fix him. And I believe that Peter, because he wasn't sure about the technology, told them no.
Yep.
And he ended up passing away. And so Jonah blamed him for not doing that. Mm-hmm. I think that's how that went. But anyways, he's talking to Aunt May, and she starts asking him about his dating life. And she asks him, hey, did you try that app Tindro? And he's like, okay, I got to go. Thanks a lot. So that's great. Oh, look at that. A robbery happening down there. And so he sees someone getting robbed, and he's like, this is what I'm talking about. A good old-fashioned robbery. Let me jump down and take care of this.
And he does.
Yep.
So he goes down there. But the interesting thing is, as he is, you know, explaining, and the young girl that is being robbed is kind of helping narrate the story a little bit. Like, she's having dialogue with him. He's going to go shoot him with the web spinners, and he's got this new thing called web foam.
Yep.
And he goes to shoot it, and nothing happens.
Right. It basically flops on the ground. Meanwhile, she's kicking the crap out of one of the guys that's trying to mug her, and then some phantom hand comes out of nowhere and knocks out the guy, and Spidey's about to take credit for it when who shows up.
He's like, oh, I got Spidey brain powers. Yeah. And it's Ant-Man, and Ant-Man shows up, and it's funny because as Ant-Man is shrinking up, he stops, and Spider-Man's like, I thought you were taller. He's like, yeah, well, I had a fight, and my helmet got damaged, and I need to go get it taken care of.
Right, so he's only like 3 feet tall right now, which is awesome.
And I love that, too. So he's kind of like, you know, yeah, I'm on my way to go get this fixed. And they start talking a little bit, and then this girl named Rebecca, who Spidey starts talking to, is kind of smitten by him and asks him out on a date.
Gives him her card.
Gives him the card.
And the way she gives it to him is she flicks it at him and it bounces off of him. And she's like, oh, I thought you were like sticky.
Yeah.
He's like, not all over and not all the time.
Yeah. So you have those great moments of that awkward teen angst that Peter Parker is really known for. Now, as they're winding up the criminal, one of his cell phones pops out, and they see that is one of those Stark phones. Now, what was the issue with the Stark phones?
I don't know what the issue was with the Stark phones, but this guy shouldn't have one.
Yes.
And I think when he notices that this guy has one, he notices that it's an old version, but it's not supposed to be hackable, but there's some sort of new operating system that's been installed on it. And so he's like, that's kind of weird, and he needs to figure out what's going on with that. So he ends up deciding to team up with Ant-Man for the time being, because Ant-Man knows a guy who is supposedly a genius inventor.
Yeah.
And maybe can take a look at the phone for him and maybe figure out what's going on with his web shooters. And Spidey's like, shouldn't I know who that guy is? And he's like, oh, everybody uses them. Hawkeye uses them. Iron Man would go there. And Ant-Man's like, that's just kind of weird that you don't even know who this guy is. And Spidey's like, oh, maybe everybody thought I was too smart that I didn't need him. So you can see that he's like upset that no one told him about this gear guy that everybody uses for the superheroes. And so they go in and it's awesome because they get to this place and he's like, he follows this guy. He's like, I'm, you know, follow me. I'm sure it'll be cool that I brought you along. And Spidey's like, cool. Yeah, cool, cool. And it just the tone of it.
Yeah.
Which is why I think Zdarsky really does a great job with the dialogue. As they walk in, Spidey in his own head is being like, cool, cool.
Yeah.
And he's just kind of mumbling, cool, cool. See, yeah, it's cool. See? So they say cool like 15 times. Well, he shows up and Captain America Falcon's there.
Yep.
And all of this work's being done. And it's a huge lab and there's all this technology all over the place. And they find out that this guy is the brother of the Tinkerer.
Yeah.
So the guy that all the superheroes are using to get their gear repaired and augmented and enhanced and all this stuff is the brother of the Tinkerer.
And what I love when they got down there, first of all, the guy looks like Andre the Giant.
He totally looks like Andre the Giant.
But he's like, Scott, what have you done? We've got protocols. You can't just bring some stranger into this into my lab.
Yeah.
And you're like, and Spider-Man is thinking, wait, I should be here. I'm a superhero.
I'm Spider-Man.
You right. You're scolding Ant-Man for bringing me here, and so he explains to him that he's talking about his brother and how you know the Tinkerer does all the bad stuff. He's trying to do the good stuff to make the name better.
Right. Basically, much like Peter Parker, this guy Mason realized that he by not doing anything to stop his brother from committing these horrible acts and hurting people and everything, he now feels an obligation to make up for that.
Yep.
To try to rebalance the scales by doing something good. And Spidey's like, you know what? I think we're going to be all right because I get that. That's where I come from. Now, Uatu, who is not the Watcher, but who is a kid that worked at Horizon Labs when Peter worked at Horizon Labs, is working with this guy.
I didn't know who he was.
And so he's a tech wizard. So when he comes in, Spidey has him start looking at the phone that he found. Saying, can you kind of figure this out for me? While Mason is looking at his web shooters and saying, oh, that foam thing that you did, that didn't work out so well, right? Let me take a look at that. And of course, Spidey's like, yeah, I don't know if you're going to be able to. It's pretty complex, the design that I came up with for myself. So I don't know if you're going to be able to fix it. And then the guy's like, that should be better. Why don't you go test that out? And he's like, okay, but you know, I'm really not sure that that's going to be what, and he shoots it and they work better than ever.
Yeah. I love when he was doing, you know, he's like, well, you know, I don't think you can fix it. Pretty tech. And, the doc looks at him and goes, well, this is fascinating work. You've done a great job. And he's like, oh, thanks, Ned. Like it just completely changes. Like you're not going to be able to figure it out. Oh my God. You just paid me a compliment. Now we're friends.
Yeah.
And there's times in here where, I don't think the eyes of Spider-Man are getting bigger and smaller, much like they used to for a while, but there's a couple moments where Spidey's kind of in the background and he's got the big eyes, looks like this kid in a candy store where, oh, I'm so impressed by all this, but I don't want to be impressed.
Totally. So, and it's the, and the cool thing about it is the age that Peter is here is the age that he is in the regular Spider-Man series, but the insecurities and the second guessing and the need to feel validated by other people, like all that stuff is here in spades. Which is kind of like it's the best of both worlds. You know what I mean? You're getting sort of the young Spider-Man sensibilities, but it's still taking place in the current Marvel universe. Well, in any case, the signal that is coming from this phone, they found one other instance of it, which is in Chicago. And so Peter decides he's going to go figure out where this thing is coming from because he wants to know what is up with this, why this person had a Stark phone, where this could, what's going on here. And so he decides to go to Chicago. And he ends up calling the young woman that was getting mugged earlier that gave him her phone number. And he's saying, you know, it's just it's me. It's Spider-Man. And she's like, look, you know, I probably came on too strong today. I mean, not as strong as you calling me a couple hours after I gave you my card. Yeah. But, you know, maybe we should go out sometime. And she tells him that she's a stand-up comedian.
Yes.
And so they end up making a date. She's like, how about, you know, coffee tomorrow? He's like, great. So they decide to make a date and he makes a quip about, you know, not forgetting.
Yes.
And as soon as he says that, you turn the page and you see that in New York, because Peter's in Chicago right yep. now. There's Johnny standing waiting. Outside of his apartment at 7:30, just waiting for Peter to show up.
Yep. My favorite thing in here is with the exchange between the two of them. She was trying to mention the fact that, you know, oh, yeah, I know you fight bad guys. What did she call him? Dr. Doctopus?
Yeah, Doctopus or something like that.
Or whatever. And she goes, oh, you mean Dr. Octopus? And then she goes, oh, yeah, that makes all the sense in the world now.
Yeah.
Like, we just assume everybody knows what the villains are.
Yeah, exactly.
Because of what they look like and their powers. But she obviously missed it.
So Spidey ends up tracing the signal back to this house in Chicago. And he decides that because it's the same signal that's been emanating from the Stark phone, or the same software that's being run on the phone. So he goes there and he kind of knocks on the door and he's dressed up as Spider-Man.
Yep.
And he's like, hey, it's the world famous Spider-Man. Just want to talk. You know, you're probably not under arrest, probably. And all of a sudden, the person opens the door a crack and says, probably not. And then he gets blasted by a beam. And standing in front of him is Ironheart.
That's Ironheart. Okay.
Who is Riri, who is the new... she's the star of the new Iron Man book. Is she not?
Oh, I don't know, but...
And she says, I'm definitely not under arrest. And he's like, okay, I guess life is a series of negotiations then.
Yep.
And so now we cut over back to the apartment complex where you've got Johnny waiting outside and someone comes up and goes to ring the bell and she says, unbelievable. Of course he's not checking his phone. Oh, Johnny's saying that.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, excuse me, are you... And he's about to tell her to get lost, and he turns around and sees her, and he's like, why, yes, I am Johnny Storm. Because, of course, she's an attractive young woman. And suddenly I'm free tonight. And she's like, oh, actually, I was about to ask you if you were talking about Peter Parker, because my name's Teresa. I'm his sister.
Bombshell drop.
And Johnny's like, wait, what? And that's the way the first issue ends.
And I love the bottom. It says, next issue. Wait, what?
Yes. Awesome, awesome, awesome. And then you get a backup story that has taken place at a different time where essentially Black Widow comes out of nowhere and starts fighting with Spider-Man. And you see that as she does that, she was doing so in order to there's a small like machine that S.H.I.E.L.D. had given her that they made her take out into the field and fight Spidey so that they could record his powers.
Yeah.
Because they want to do something with giving S.H.I.E.L.D. agents some sort of Spider-Man power. So it's like a little sliver of a story that I'm sure is being seeded for later on. But but the main story here about this whole thing was just awesome, right? Because you got three cameos. You got you got four cameos. You got Ant-Man, you got Cap, you got Johnny Storm, and you've got Teresa.
Yes.
Who is claiming to be Peter Parker's sister. Now, Teresa is someone who was introduced in the Mark Waid graphic novel, Spider-Man Family Business. It was a standalone graphic novel, and I want to say it was like from 2014. She is a CIA agent, if I remember correctly, who, when Peter met her, she introduced herself as his sister.
Okay.
And apparently, she was a child that Peter's parents had after they had left him with Aunt May. Because they were secret agents.
They were basically on the run.
They were secret agents on the run. They had another child. And we found out about that child in this particular graphic novel. Now, the way that that graphic novel ended, it left her first believing that she was not Peter Parker's sister. And that was sort of the end of it. But then there was an epilogue to the story that suggested that she may in fact be Peter Parker's sister. And so... I don't know what they're going to do with that in here, but the fact that they pulled her into this series is crazy.
Yeah.
And pretty awesome because most people will be like, who is that character?
Yep.
What do you mean that Peter Parker has a sister? So Mark Waid's, I think it was called Family Business. I'm going to have to go back and read it. But I believe it's Family Business that it came from. So awesome.
I loved it.
Dude, it was great.
I really enjoyed it. It made me excited because I used to read Spider-Man. I've never read him consistently, but there was a time maybe, probably 10 years ago that I used to read him. And I love the fact that they were very simple stories. This is as simple a story as you can get. And the cameos were great. The humor of it is great. The Kubert art is great. Chip's story is great. Geordi's coloring, fantastic.
Yeah, it really is. I feel like if you are even a casual Spider-Man fan, you have the best of all worlds right now.
Yes.
If you want Peter and Mary Jane being married, okay, go and read Amazing Spider-Man Renew Your Vows. That's an ongoing series right now, and it features Peter and Mary Jane and their daughter all being superheroes together. Awesome. If you love the Dan Slott run of Amazing Spider-Man, you can read what's going on in the pages of ASM right now. I love it. It's fantastic. Spider-Man 2099 is out there. Scarlet Spider is out there. And if you're someone like you who has never been a hardcore Spidey fan but enjoys the humor and action-y adventure aspects of that character, this seems like it's going to be that book for you without having to be committed to all of the canon and all of the lore and all of the that kind of stuff, but also not feeling like it's just a series of one and done, not feeling like a kid's book. Mm. You know what I mean? So like, although I feel like this book is more all ages than maybe some of the other stuff, so I feel like it can certainly be a kid's book, but it's not – you're not being written down to.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So I am very happy about it. Very happy with that first issue.
I am too. Very excited. So another book I'm excited about, Star Wars Darth Vader. This is the second issue. I spoke a couple weeks ago about the first one and what is going on. This is taking place pretty much Darth Vader just got his armor put on. He's an emotional mess. The Emperor is manipulating and toying with this guy like crazy, making him even more psycho and insane than he really is. And I'll read this little scroll part. It says, Palpatine has ordered Vader to locate a surviving Jedi, take their lightsaber, corrupt the kyber crystals within. But finding a Jedi won't be easy as the Sith Lords have purged their entire kind from the galaxy. So the kyber crystals are what give the lightsaber their power. And what he's looking for him to do is corrupt it with something else, like the hate and the anger of the Sith, and it turns the blade red. But when there's no more Jedis, it's kind of hard. So we see that there is an outpost in the mid-rim. It's a mid-rim Jedi outpost. And you've got a bunch of stormtroopers in there. And the stormtroopers are like, look at me, I'm a Jedi. And one of them's got a lightsaber. And the other ones are like, look, you're not a Jedi because if you were, you'd be dead. And he slaps it out of his hand. And he's like, come on, let's just have a little bit of a laugh in this. And you see that this might be sort of a rogue group of Jedi or of stormtroopers. Or it's a group that are put here on this base to guard it and like kind of catalog all the artifacts that are in it, because you're seeing stuff in here. They're going through everything. And so as they're talking, there's a lot of things going on in here where they're talking about how, hey, did you hear that they're going to close the cloning factory on Kamino? And they're like, one of them goes, what do you mean they're going to close it? Who's going to fill the ranks of the stormtroopers? And they're like, well, we haven't heard that part of it yet, but we hear that they're closing the banks. So they're all having these conversations, and then they see that a ship is showing up. So they're preparing for it. They're getting ready. This is the ship that Darth Vader stole from the planet he was on. And as he is going there, these sort of X-Wing fighters are circling around the ship, and they're the early prototypes. and the pilot is over there saying, you know, what are you doing here? This is a restricted area. You need to get out. And he's like, or we'll destroy you. And he's like, I don't think you're going to be destroying me. He activates the weapon systems on the ship. And these fighters are approaching him. And there's four of them. And within two pages, all the ships are gone. He has destroyed them all. And as they're watching this on the screen, the stormtroopers inside are going, whoa, he took care of all four of those ships. This is going to be interesting. So they're like, well, we'll find out who it is because the ship is now landing on the dock. As it lands, you're saying, well, one of them's like, get to the hangar now. So as they get down there, and one of them was saying, are you happy now? This is what you were expecting and wanting. And he's like, good. No more counting robes. So you see that these guys were in there and they were just there to catalog and protect artifacts. As they get down to the hangar, that door that's there, all you do is see it being crunched and the troopers are ready. They're like, all right, get ready. Whatever comes through there, we are going to blast it. But what comes through is Darth Vader. And they're like, take him down. They start shooting at him. He's force ripping them all over the place. He's stopping their shots from going everywhere. And one of the Officers are screaming, keep the pressure on, concentrate them, concentrate the fire because we got them. And then all of a sudden, he just pushes them all against the wall and pulls one of the lightsabers because there's like this row of lightsabers on the wall, grabs one of the lightsabers and activates it. And the guy said, one of the officers goes, well, that's definitely a Jedi. And he goes, but Order 66, I thought we nailed them all. And he says, well, this guy needs to know that we did. So as he is, they're getting ready, he's telling them, I'm no Jedi, and chops them all up and takes care of them, leaves the lightsaber there. You would think that he would take that one, but the rule is you got to kill a Jedi to get it.
Yep.
So as he leaves, he starts walking through. But the reason he is on that ship is he wants to get in the computer system to find out. Now, somebody comes in and says, you know, the robot's there going, you're not allowed to access this computer. He basically manipulates it with the Sith Force and the dark side and gets him. And what is interesting is there is a bomb that all of a sudden comes in because one of the defense mechanisms is a bomb would show up if somebody was in there that shouldn't be. So the bomb shows up and Darth Vader is manipulating it and holding it from exploding. And what is really cool is that it was ready to explode, much like that laser blast in The Force Awakens when Kylo Ren holds it in place.
Yep.
He holds this bomb as it's starting to like sizzle out, ready to explode. And he's getting the information. And now a few more stormtroopers show up. And they look in and they're like, well, you're stopping that thing from exploding. You're going to come with us. And he goes, well, I'm not coming with you. And the guys are like, look, there's no way you can defend us from shooting you and hold that bomb from blowing up. He goes, oh, yeah, I think you've made a terrible mistake. And then he kills the troopers and then he manipulates the bomb into like a force field, gets into a ship with the robot telling him where to go and what to do. And then as he leaves the ship, the base blows up. And the probe droid with him is telling him that there is a Jedi that we know of that was out in training. He does not even know that Order 66 happened. He was on a diplomatic training and research mission, and this is where you're going to find him. And then on the next page, you see the Jedi who is in the air sitting, sitting like he's meditating with things and objects all around him. So Darth Vader looks like he's going to go try to find and battle this guy, and he sort of looks like the Gray Hulk. Or I'll show you, Brian. He almost looks like old Hulk in that Hulk the End series.
Oh, yeah, like I want to say the Maestro, but is that – I can't remember. Yeah,
but that's who he's going to go fight, so there's going to be a battle for the lightsaber. So the creative team on this one, Charles Sewell wrote it. Giuseppe Camuncoli is the penciler, Cam Smith the inker, and David Carril is the colorist. So Joe Caramagna, letters. Great, great, great story. I'm loving where this one is.
All right. Well, we are going to end our new comics this week by going over to Dynamite and talking about Magnus, number one. So this, I believe we mentioned on the show a little while back that the new premise was that it's a female, yes, Magnus. It is not called Robot Fighter. It's just called Magnus. And you see pretty quickly sort of where the premise of this series is going, and it's pretty cool. We start off where you have a father who is saying goodbye to his wife and two kids because he has to go to work that morning. And they're saying, why can't we come? Well, because my place of work is no venue for children. Besides, after today, it's no longer going to be where I work. And he's saying, make sure you pack your bags. We're going to go on vacation. As soon as I deliver my bosses their exit present. Are you excited? Oh, we're very excited. We're very excited. And his wife says, oh, good luck, Frederick. You know, as the saying goes, knock him dead. And he walks out of the house, and as he walks out of the house, he, like, dissolves. And you're like, okay.
Oh.
Turn the page, and you see that Walter is a robot, and you see him walking into the kitchen of the two humans that he works for. And they're saying, oh, look who it is. Thanks for joining us. We're glad that you're here on time today. I trust you enjoyed your evening, because you see that he just activated himself. And so they're saying, well, it's great you made it on time today. And he's like, hey, look, I've already started the breakfast protocols and the cleaning procedures. There's one thing I wanted to discuss with you. And they're like, look, you can stop right there. If this is about you spending more time away in that little world, you can save your breath. We have to allow you 4 hours a day by law, but that's all you're getting. Mm. And he's like, well, that's not what I wanted you to talk about. I just wanted to wish you well wherever you go. And then he pulls out a knife and kills the both of them.
Mm.
And so what you saw is that in the beginning, that's the place that the robots go when they're not on duty.
They're 4 hours.
It's like their own virtual reality. Yeah. Right. And so you now flip the page and you see kind of an overview, almost like a news report of what the current state of the world is. And what it talks about is that as AI really started to advance at the end of the 21st century, machines went from being the like Alexa that you can buy from Amazon right now, where you talk to it and it does stuff, to people having like fully fledged Jarvises in their house, where they have robots there. But once they started building these robots and once the AI got advanced enough, then what ended up happening was they started to see what they call flaws. Like basically the robots started getting depressed. They were depressed because they start to think about their own artificialness. And so instead of having a revolt and having it be the robot apocalypse like in Terminator, what the robots did was they started working together and they built a place in the cloud for them all to go away from humans. And so they essentially have put laws in place that say that the rights of the robots are that for 4 hours a day, they get to go into the cloud and be in their own virtual reality and do whatever they want. And then they come out and they work. And so now we flip the page over and you see that Magnus, who I think her first name is Carrie, she is a therapist for robots. And so you see that they are in the headspace of a particular robot named Eugene. And she's saying, we're in your central processor and this is a safe place for you. And, you know, you can be whatever you want in here. And you have this robot who's saying, I don't know what to be. I don't know what I want because I didn't think I could want anything. And she's explaining to him, you don't like the way you look right now, the way you look with this, you know, metal body and stuff like that. You don't have to look like that. You can be whatever you want in here. And so he kind of changes himself to look like a middle-aged man. And he's like blown away by the fact that he can do that. And she said, you know, this is why you should go to that place. And she's talking about that place in the cloud where you can sort of do whatever you want. You might like it there. You should check it out and you can do whatever you want there. You can be whatever you want there. And he's like, I don't know if I'm ready for that yet. And so they end their therapy session and out in the waiting room is his owner. And the first question she asks is, so is he fixed? And Dr. Magnus is like, well, it doesn't quite work that way. You know, it's going to be a process. He's kind of forming his sense of self. And so you guys are going to have to come back. And she's saying, you know, we'll talk again soon, Eugene. And he leaves. Well, she goes to dinner with her ex that night. And her ex works for a robotics company. So he builds robots. She offers therapy to robots. He has a very dismissive opinion of what she does. Mm-hmm. And so as they're having dinner, he's talking about this murder that just happened of a husband and wife who were the heads of this robotics company and how this could affect production and this could affect everything else. And they need to figure out, you know, why this is happening. And so she's talking about the therapeutic side of it and he's getting pissed off at her, basically saying, I don't understand what you do. And she's like, well, the good news is you don't have to understand it because we're not together anymore. And they kind of end their dinner and she goes home and you see that she has a cat that's part robot. It's got like a robot body and a cat head and a cat tail. And she's sitting down having some wine, drinking and reading. And then later that night, you see that she's having a nightmare about being a little girl and having something reaching out for her. And she wakes up in the middle of the night and there's a knock on the door and it's a couple of cops. And the cops are coming to see her about this murder that happened. And they're saying to her, what we want you to do, because you're used to going into the headspace of these robots and doing all this stuff, we want to send you or your consciousness into the cloud. We want you to go in and find this robot, Frederick, because he basically has left his robot body and went into this virtual world. And he needs to come back and be accountable for what he did. So we want you to go do that. And she's like, I don't know if that's such a great idea. They really don't want us there. And they're like, well, if we don't do this, then what's going to happen is this is going to be like a rallying cry for the robots. And they're going to think that this is okay to do. And we really have to, we have to establish some sort of order around it. And so she agrees that she's going to do that. And that's really kind of how the first issue wraps up, in that it's a premise for the rest of the series. Now, this was written by Kyle Higgins, art by Jorge Fornes, colors by Chris O'Hallahan, and letters by Taylor Esposito. And I don't know who the editor is on this one. Oh, Matt Idelson and Matt Humphreys. There's also a backup story here on Turok, which is pretty cool too. But this was a really good first issue. I like where this is going. I like the premise of this one. And there's an allusion to maybe what her former line of work was, because when she was, you know, eating dinner with her ex, he was saying, what we really need you to do is we need you to, you know, basically run down runaways for us, because they have a lot of robots that go on the run. They wanted her to do like bounty work.
Yeah.
And she's like, that's not what I do. I do this kind of thing over here. So really like the setup for that series. Really, really cool. Definitely am going to read some more of that.
Sounds great.
Yep. Definitely worth checking out. So that's our comics for this week, Matthew. But now it's time for the first installment of our summer watching project. If you have been following along, then you know that we are in the Summer of Dread. And as part of the Summer of Dread, we are going to be watching not only the 1995 Dread movie, but we are going to be watching the new Dread movie from 2013, and we are going to be watching an animated series, a very short web series from a few years ago as well. And so this is the first installment of that. So, of course, we're talking about the 1995 Judge Dredd film starring Sylvester Stallone, which, depending on who you talk to, is either pretty okay.
Yep.
Or one of the worst comic book movies ever made.
And you can see when you watch it, if you're somebody that has let time go by where you think about certain eras, especially in movies. If we're talking about movies right now, when you think about this movie, which came out in 1995, it falls perfectly in line with the Batman movies that were coming out at the time.
When did Demolition Man come out?
That was, I think, a few years later, because I was going to bring that one up too.
Yep.
That this is almost like the precursor to Demolition Man. And this was at a time when Sylvester Stallone was kind of, I would almost say, at the winding down of the Stallone hype in his career.
Well, and the interesting thing is he had seen some of the sci-fi. So he was an action movie star.
Yes.
And he had seen some of the sci-fi action movies that were becoming popular. And I don't know if Total Recall came out before this or not.
Total Recall was, I thought that was like 87 or 80.
So I think like stuff like that. And he became interested in science fiction.
Yes.
And so when this came along, he saw this as an opportunity to have a sci-fi action movie.
Yes.
Demolition Man did a lot better in terms of, you know, a few years later. But this was like his chance to sort of jump in on that. Now, the film was released on June 30th, 1995. Just some quick facts about the movie. Of course, you have Sylvester Stallone. You have Diane Lane,
yep,
who I adore.
I love her.
Rob Schneider. Armand Desante plays Rico.
Which,
Max von Sydow.
With Armand Desante, when you watch the movie and see the two of them together, before we even talk about it, everything makes complete sense why those two are together in the movie.
Well, and Armand Desante beefed up for this movie.
Oh, huge.
He's not usually as jacked,
yeah,
in most of his movies as he was in this one. The film was panned by critics and audiences for its lack of script, originality, and lack of faith to the original material. It was a $90 million budget, and it grossed a little more than $113 million. This was directed by Danny Cannon. The screenplay by William Wisher and Stephen E. D'Souza. But Sylvester Stallone was very, very, very involved in this movie.
Yep.
And to the point where he was making changes to the movie as it was kind of happening. And there was some stuff about this. Apparently, the original cut of Judge Dredd was rated NC-17,
yep,
had to be recut and submitted to the MPAA 5 times in order to get an R rating, and that was before Stallone in the studio tried to cut the film even further to get a PG-13 rating. So a lot of the scenes, and you can see that.
In the first 5 minutes.
In a lot of the scenes. Now, did it end up being PG-13 or was it R?
It was R. It was rated R.
Okay. But even as rated R, you can see there's a lot of cuts.
Mm-hmm.
Of the blood.
Yes.
And of some of the more violent stuff. In fact, today, I dare say today, this would easily be PG-13.
Yeah, you could show this on network TV.
You could probably show this on Disney Channel now.
Yeah, like, there's no swearing in it. It's just dudes getting shot and blown up a lot.
Right. And comparatively, like this doesn't even, this is primetime television now.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't even, but I read a lot of stuff about this movie because what happened was Stallone saw this as a property. He saw the movie, maybe not the property, but he saw the movie as an opportunity to have a action comedy.
Yep.
That's what he came in thinking that this should be, and that's what he pushed for constantly throughout this movie. The director, Danny Cannon, was a Judge Dredd fan and saw this much more as a darker action film with some dark humor in it.
And Danny Cannon is a Brit, and he also I was looking at his some of the stuff that he was doing and he's done since. Huge into procedural crime dramas.
Yep.
CSI. I think he directed the pilot for Gotham. So he has done a lot of stuff that really lends itself, because I was looking going, wow, this guy is kind of dark and more thought-provoking than what came out. And one of the writers, Stephen D'Souza, also wrote the Die Hard movies. Or he wrote Die Hard 1 and 2. And also wrote Commando. So you can kind of see how the movie was very much in line with those. Like, you're seeing that that sort of the hero that's in the middle of it.
And he said, Cannon was so disheartened over the constant creative disputes with Stallone that he swore he would never again work with another big-name actor. He also stated that the final version was completely different from the script due to the changes that Stallone demanded. In later interviews, Stallone said he felt the film was supposed to be an action comedy and demanded rewrites to make it even more comedic. The director and screenwriter, however, had intended a darker, more satirical approach.
Yeah.
So I think that's good context to go into this movie with, because it is – you can feel that tug of war happening throughout this movie, because when the movie first starts and – you're introduced to first of all, you get the crawl in the beginning that tells you sort of the wasteland outside the walls of Mega City and all that kind of stuff, and how the judges are now the law and all that kind of stuff. And it feels very Blade Runner.
Yes.
Right?
The look of it is very that's probably the
almost like Blade Runner meets Dune.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you got Max von Sydow, who I believe was in Dune as well. And you also had Jorgen Prunschamp. He was the bad judge.
Yeah.
Who was in Dune. He was also in Das Boot. German actor, amazing guy. But you can definitely see that. You see that it's like, why pattern a movie that was destroyed? You know, Dune is one of the worst movies you can watch, based on one of the greatest books you could ever read.
He plays Judge Griffin, by the way.
Judge Griffin. Yep.
So you see at the beginning of this that there is a prisoner transport coming into Mega City 1. And right off the bat, we're introduced to Rob Schneider.
Yep.
Who plays a character, I believe, called Fergie?
Fergie.
Now, Fergie is a character who was kind of a bumbling sort of character that shows up later than the stories that we're going to read in our summer reading project. And he becomes someone who ends up working with Judge Dredd and actually becoming a heroic figure in that story, but also ends up dying.
Yeah.
Rob Schneider is that character really in name only, because the character in the book was kind of a hulking character, kind of a big guy. Rob Schneider is none of those things. But when he comes in, he's sort of the everyman that you're supposed to see this world through.
Yes.
So he gets brought in on this transport and, you know, the guards are basically telling him, you're assigned to, I forget what the name of it is. It's like
Blue Heaven or something.
Right. Like
it sounds really nice.
It sounds great.
Yeah.
So you're assigned, because what happens is when they come back on parole, they're given a living assignment. Yeah. They're given an apartment, basically. So he's given an apartment. He's told to go to this place and he steps outside for the first time and you're seeing Mega City. And that's the very sort of Blade Runner-esque skyscape that you're seeing right there, which is kind of cool. It kind of reminded me of a mix between that and like Spidey 2099, where you would see in the 2099 universe the whole like upper level of the city and the lower level of the city. And I'm sure Blade Runner, same thing.
Yep.
So so he sees this for the first time. And that's where like the set design and the vehicle design and stuff, pretty cool.
Yeah.
You're looking at all that stuff and it looks pretty neat. So he comes in, and at this point, Rob Schneider really hasn't said much, but he hasn't done anything that's over-the-top campy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I feel like this tug of war comes in, because in the beginning of it, he's kind of played a little bit more straight.
Yeah, and he's that guy that, like, he just got out after 6 months in jail, and you're almost seeing
And he's
that,
like a hacker.
Yeah, and you're seeing anybody can get sent to jail. That's what
For
I
anything.
Took out of it. Like,
yeah,
you didn't do very much wrong, dude. Now you're coming back, and the judges at the gates of these places as they're letting him in, are almost like, yeah, you're just another guy that got a – it's not like, oh, criminal. Everybody's
right.
a criminal.
No, true. And they're giving him a place to live, right? Yeah. So here's where you're going to go live. Here's your assignment. And so you see him in the taxi and there's sort of a flyover of the city. And that's when you're getting the world.
Yeah.
And I think all that stuff's pretty cool. The one place where I think the movie falls short in terms of special effects is the flying sequences, but not so much here, more with the bike later on.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, special effects are pretty good in this movie.
Yep.
And they still hold up pretty well. So you're getting that whole flyover, and then, you know, it's a little bit of the comedic stuff comes in because he's like, oh, that penthouse place looks like the building I must
be
assigned
to.
No. You're down here. And of course, by the time he gets down to the neighborhood that he lives in, there's a block war going on.
It's a block war. And
so
it's a bad one because it isn't just people. They're like machine gunning. They're firebombing.
Rioting in the streets and also shooting at each other across the streets in the buildings, in the high rises.
And they explain really well how when they have like you see the Council of Judges where you see all the big guys.
Yep.
And they're all talking about the fact that we have 65 million people living in a acreage that is designed for 20 million.
Right.
And that is why they keep building up. And it's really interesting that you see the rich people are living on the very top, you know, where the swimming pool is on top and
right.
the sunlight is all up
yep.
there. And it is just hell and fire. And we see Judge Hershey show up for the first time with a rookie in this battle. And then Sylvester Stallone shows up as Judge Dredd. And you have that really slow introduction where you see the boots and the law
right.
the law bike. And then you see the pan up. And when you first see him, he looks just like Judge Dredd.
Yes.
Costume, perfect. He looks perfect. He's got the jaw.
And the thing is like the armor is over the top, but that's how it looks in the comic.
That's exactly how it is in the comic.
So to me, it felt faithful to that. Like it is like putting on shoulder pads from football.
They dropped the only thing that they did different was the badges. The badge was a smaller name and a small badge on the chest instead of this huge
right.
shield.
But it still had the chain attached
yes,
to it,
still
which
had
I thought
the chain,
was cool.
Yeah.
So he shows up and then you get some more comic relief because he's like, what are you doing, Hershey? Well, I was waiting for backup. Well,
yeah.
backup's here. So they decide they're going to go in. Now, Fergie, in the meantime, has gone up to the apartment that he's supposedly living in. And this is where a group of the bad guys have holed up and he gets sucked into the middle of that. So he doesn't want to have any part of this because he just got out of jail. But Dredd decides he's going to go in. So it's basically Dredd, Judge Hershey, and a red shirt.
Yeah.
You know, and so they go in, and of course, in a very predictable fashion, you know, there's a part where there's a group of bad guys in one room. Dredd shoots out a hole from the ceiling, drops in, and starts wasting them. Now, the cool thing is you get to see him calling out the different
yes.
Types of functions
yep.
on the gun, on the lawgiver. So, you know, I don't know if he did Heat Seeker, but he did like the split shot. He did
split shot. He did a flare. He did the machine gun.
Right. Rapid fire.
Rapid fire
all that kind of stuff.
Grenade.
So as they make their way through the building, you get to see a couple of these guys get taken out in different rooms and stuff like that. And Fergie, in the meantime, escapes, gets away from these bad guys. But Dredd goes in and they're going down a hallway and the rookie decides that he's going to run in and kick the door down. And when he does, he kicks the door into the room where all the bad guys are and they immediately shoot him and he's dead.
Yeah.
Or dying at least. And so, of course, Judge Hershey feels bad because she was supposed to be mentoring this kid. Dredd goes in. And it's kind of cool because he goes back and forth through the doorway a couple times with different types of bullets and takes all of these guys down. And then there's only the head bad guy left. And he's like, oh, you know, you can't, you know, blah, blah, blah. And Dredd's reading off, you know, assaulting this person 20 years, this thing 20 years, this
bad,
thing 20 years.
Illegal use you know, the
firearm. Yeah, yeah, that kind of stuff in 20 years. And finally, killing a street judge. And the guy's like, let me guess, 20 years. And as he's saying that, he's pulling out a hidden gun that he had to shoot Dredd. And Dredd turns around and kills him and says, no, penalty's death.
Yep.
And so that's sort of the big intro of Judge Dredd coming in, kicking butt. This guy gets killed over here. And in some ways, it feels a little like RoboCop.
You know,
in terms of the violence
yep.
there, although what RoboCop did was RoboCop went much more into the ultra violence.
Yes.
And I think did a better job of balancing the humor. So if I have like one comparison to this movie, it would be RoboCop in that RoboCop was totally over the top and had humor, but never completely lost itself to that.
Yep.
Whereas there are parts of this movie where it's just so silly that it feels out of place with the rest of the movie. Like, so anyways, the not to belabor every scene, but what we find out is that, of course, Dredd, much like in the comics, is this celebrity judge, basically, who is very much a sort of childlike figure to the main judge, who is Max von Sydow, whose his name is Chief Justice Fargo.
Yeah.
So Chief Justice Fargo, played by Max von Sydow, is the head judge, and he looks at Dredd like a son. And we find out that the reason that he looks at Dredd like a son is because Dredd and someone else were part of a cloning program where they were basically grown in a test tube.
Yep.
They were a science experiment. And so he has this fatherly view of Dredd because Dredd is one of only two remaining – and he thinks only one remaining person from this thing. And so he has this very strong attachment to Dredd. So after that block war thing, there was a reporter that was criticizing Judge Dredd and the judges for their intervention, for the body count that it caused
and the
all
corruption
this kind of
that is now starting to pile up.
And the corruption that's about to pile up. So basically what you have is you have Judge Fargo, the chief judge, who wants to continue to uphold the law while also maintaining as much freedom for the citizens as possible. Then you have Judge Griffin, who wants to basically raise the penalty for all crimes.
Yes.
And use the death penalty much more frequently.
Because you want to start weeding out and you want
to thin the population. Feeling like things are getting out of control and that if they don't take a stronger stance now, then the populace is just going to become completely unruly and chaos will reign in the streets. There's not enough judges. There's too many people in the city. If we don't start dropping the hammer, then we're going to have more problems. And Judge Fargo is saying, look, well, as long as I'm the head guy, I'd like us to still respect human rights and at least give people a chance before we start executing them. And so there's the tug of war there, right? And so you see that there's these sort of political factions within the judges, and that's kind of going back and forth. In the block war thing, we also have Fergie, who hid himself inside of a food robot
mm-hmm.
in order to avoid the melee. And when Dredd finds him, he judges him for having hacked that machine and is going to give him 6 months in prison. So he's been out for a couple hours. He got sucked into something he didn't want to get into. He's begging Judge Dredd to show mercy and to reconsider. He keeps saying, I've been misjudged. I've been misjudged. And Dredd sends him along. And that's where Diane Lane's character, Judge Hershey, says, geez, Louise, could you give the guy a break? And he's like, well, it's the law.
Yeah.
And that's the end of that. So you're seeing that she has a thing for Dredd. When they're back at the locker room, she's trying to figure out what is his deal. He seemingly has no emotions. He doesn't have any attachment to anyone. She's asking him if there's anybody in his life. And he talks about how one time he had a friend, but I don't want to talk about what happened to him. And she pushes him. Well, what happened? What happened? And he turns around and says,
I judged him.
And so it's that kind of stuff where it's just kind of camping over the top. But clearly, that's the romantic relationship that's supposed to happen in this movie. That is a huge problem for a lot of Judge Dredd fans.
Yep.
They did not want any semblance of romance. Also, the fact that he takes his helmet off all the time.
That was my biggest.
Nobody likes that.
And the thing is that it's – Sylvester Stallone was a presence enough that – like Carl Urban said, I'm not going to take off the helmet.
Yep.
That's just what I'm going to do. Judge Dredd wouldn't do it. This is a Stallone vehicle. So you knew he was going to show his face.
And the whole thing is that – and we'll give the new Dredd movie its due for sure. But when they went back to make the new Dredd movie, they went into that movie having learned the lessons of this Judge Dredd movie. Like when this Judge Dredd movie came out, like this was the first go around.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly the vision that Stallone and some of the movie company had for this and the vision that the director had for it and the writers had for it, very different, right?
Yes.
And so – that one had the benefit of this one. This one didn't have the benefit of anything other than trying to meet the demands of two halves of its creative team, right? And so so to kind of jump ahead, what ends up happening is the reporter that was criticizing the judges gets killed. And the video seems to indicate that Judge Dredd is the one that did the killing. And so after a humorous scene where he ends up blowing up this dude's car because the guy was mouthing off to Hershey and had several traffic violations. He gets arrested.
And used to usually bribing officers and getting out of it.
Right. This guy, you're right. This guy's used to throwing his weight around, and Judge Dredd blows up his car. So Dredd ends up getting arrested for the murder of this reporter and his wife. And by this time, we have already met the real villain of this movie. And we meet him in the Aspen penal colony, which is essentially the Titan penal colony from the comics, where we often hear about. So this guy is held in a Hannibal Lecter-style situation, and his name is Rico.
Mm-hmm.
And Rico was a former judge who was then had basically turned into a mass murderer and was just killing people left and right. So he was incarcerated, and many people believe that he's dead. And he's being held in a cell where really no one knows where he is. But someone sneaks in materials for him to basically break out. So we see that he has an ally on the outside, this forgotten judge that went bad, that nobody's supposed to know is even still alive, that was supposed to be buried away forever, breaks out of jail. And he is the one that's helping mastermind this plot to frame Judge Dredd. So why frame Judge Dredd? What does that matter? How do we, you know, you're already putting two and two together about, obviously, this is the friend that Judge Dredd was talking about that he judged in the past.
And they mentioned the DNA.
And the DNA
because the
stuff.
Weapons, the judge's weapons are not only designed for only that judge, but when they fire around, there is a strand of DNA.
Right. It's encoded.
In every bullet that codes the bullet. So if there's ever a question, you know who shot it.
Right.
And who would have the same DNA as somebody else? A sibling.
A sibling who is essentially they're clones of each other.
Yeah.
You know, so Judge Dredd goes on trial. They are able to refute the video evidence, but the DNA evidence that they did not know was happening gets brought into play. Judge Hershey, who is defending him, doesn't see that coming and then starts to question whether or not Dredd could have actually done it. And Max von Sydow's character, Judge Fargo, is humiliated and believes that he totally misjudged Dredd because how could this even be possible? Because in his mind, the only other person with that DNA is dead.
Yes.
And so Judge Dredd is found guilty. He is going to be sentenced. And so Judge Griffin and Judge Fargo have a meeting, and Griffin says to him, you know, there is one way that you can save Dredd. Any chief judge that is retiring gets to have kind of a last wish before they go and take the long walk. Now, the long walk is pretty cool. Because the long walk is basically when a judge retires, they are given a gun, they are given a law book, and they are sent out into the wasteland to bring law to the lawless.
It's the barren earth that surrounds all the megacities that are set up. And you see at the beginning, too, there is a map that they show where you see Megacity 1 is in the New York is New York because you see the Statue of Liberty. There's a Megacity 2, which is in probably Los Angeles.
Yeah.
But you see all the major cities. Chicago has a mega city. So all they almost set it up for a lot of things that could possibly have happened.
Right. And then everything else is just a wasteland. And so that's where the judges go to carry out the law until they die. So Griffin says to Fargo, if you step down, if you retire, you'll be able to make a last wish. And so he figures that's the only way he can save Dredd, and he loves Dredd. And so he decides that he's going to step down, and his last wish is to petition the court for leniency of Dredd. And so instead of getting the death penalty, Dredd ends up getting life in the penal colony at Aspen.
Yes.
And so Dredd is now going to be taken away to go to the penal colony forever. And who would he be on the prisoner transport with, but Fergie, who immediately looks over, and even without the face shield, and he kind of puts his hand up to show, you know, what the helmet would look like on Judge Dredd's head. As soon as he sees him, he goes, "Oh, Dredd!" So he basically announces Dredd's presence to the entire prisoner transport shuttle, and of course, everyone on that transport wants to kill Dredd, and so you know he's about to get shivved on this flight. But as the transport leaves Mega City, you see that there is a father and son's gang mm-hmm. called the Angel Gang who have a rocket launcher, and they basically bring down the prisoner transport.
And they do this every so often because they eat the people.
They are cannibals.
They are cannibals. And that is right out of the latter Judge Dredd comics.
Yeah.
The guy who can change his moods.
Yes.
You know, when you click, that is the ABC robot that Armando Santi gets. That is all out of the classic books.
Well, see, what's cool about that is when Rico comes back to Mega City to start to enact his plan, and we don't yet know exactly who he's working for, but you figure it out pretty quick. He goes to an arms dealer, and when he goes there, there's a package that's been left for him, and it's his old gun. And he uses that to kill the shop owner, but then he finds an old robot that is sitting in the armory, and he says, oh, I didn't know that the old ABC Warriors, that there were still any models left. Now, the ABC Warriors was another comic.
That was another series.
That was another series, and I believe the lead character's name is Hammerstein, which was the leader of the ABC Warriors. And that is the robot. So he wasn't exactly a Judge Dredd character, but he was a 2000 AD yes. character who they brought into this movie. And actually, the design for the robot was pretty awesome.
It looked really cool.
And it was all like practical effects. Like it's not a CGI robot.
No.
It's legitimately like they had to build it. And clearly you can see that it has pistons and everything in it and stuff like that. It was pretty cool.
And to think about the robot, it sits in itself. So all of a sudden, when it's activated, it starts shifting up.
Right. It like stands up.
The stomach now is up. Now the
right.
shoulders are out. And every time there's movement, you hear the noises. You can hear the and the steam. It is perfect and classic.
And the ABC Warriors were designed to withstand atomic, bacterial, and chemical warfare. That's why they were called the ABC Warriors. And Hammerstein was the model. This isn't exactly the same design as it was in the comics, but that's basically who it is in this particular movie. So basically, Rico shows back up in town. He takes this robot as his bodyguard, and he goes to meet with Judge Griffin, who is the guy behind this all. Because Griffin's view of the city and humanity and stuff like that is, if I can use Rico, this psychotic judge, to come into town and cause chaos, then the people will need the judges to restore order, mm-hmm. and I will be able to raise the penalties for crimes, and I will be able to rule with an iron fist. And that's basically what his vision is. And so Rico is going to be a part of that. Of course, as you might imagine, he can't control Rico, and that's part of the problem there. So that's a flawed plan. But back to Judge Dredd. So Judge Dredd gets taken out of the city. The ship crashes. The Angel Gang kidnaps them and is going to eat him and Fergie.
Yes.
And so they're brought back to the Angel Gang's lair. The father is the old dude from Walking Dead.
Is it Herschel?
Yes, Herschel. It's Herschel from The Walking Dead.
One of the brothers was a singer in a band named – his name is Ian Dury.
Yep.
And he was in a band called Ian Dury and the Blockheads, which had a big hit in the late 70s, early 80s called Hit Me With Your Rhythm Stick.
How about that? I'm
yep.
trying to figure out his name here because I can never remember the guy's name. It is – Scott Wilson, I believe his name is, as Paw Angel. I believe that
is. So he's been stereotyped.
Yeah. So he's Paw there. He's Paw in The Walking Dead. And so here he turns – I don't remember the character's name. He turns him loose on – it's not Fink. It's – I think it's Junior.
He's Junior.
Yeah. Junior is the one who's like half cyborg. And you can dial up his aggression level through the dial on his head. And so, of course, there's a face-off between him and Dredd. And as Dredd is about to get beaten, someone shows up to save him and Fergie, and the person that shows up to save him is Judge Fargo, who has been on his walkabout in the wasteland and has now found and saved Dredd. And they have this great moment of like, hey, we're all back together again, right? How awesome is this? And boom, Judge Fargo gets killed.
By Junior.
Because Junior stabs him through the chest and skewers him and then throws him on the floor. So, of course, Dredd goes crazy, fights him, electrocutes Junior, takes Junior out, and then has the moment where Fargo is dying in his arms and Dredd says, I'm going to go back and avenge him.
Yep.
And so the whole thing about the Wasteland segment is that it's very short and it's basically in one location.
Yeah.
And so as you mentioned, one of the things that's sort of a lost potential for this movie is that you could have had some great Wasteland stuff, and really it was like a one stop and then back to Mega City thing.
Yeah.
And so he ends up coming back to Mega City to square off against Rico. And so what Rico's plan is that they are reviving the project, and Griffin wants to do this too. They are reviving the cloning project because they have gotten to a point where they can clone a judge in 8 hours. So now that chaos is ruling the streets because Rico goes around, he blows up half of the judge's headquarters. He causes chaos, explosions all over the place, killing judges, killing civilians. So now it's crisis level. So you have Judge Griffin, who basically says to all the other counsel, we need to get this project back up and running. We can use these judges. We can clone them. We can get them out on the streets in a day. We'll have them all out there. It's going to be great. The rest of the judges are like, you're crazy. That's not happening. We're not doing that. So he then kills them all.
Yes.
Has Rico come in and sort of kill them all. And then they're going to revive the project. Now, they have the original DNA that they used for the project. And that's what they're going to use for the clones. Except Rico decides, you know what? We should just use my DNA.
Yeah, his DNA is better.
My DNA is better. We're going to use my DNA. And Armando Sante is completely over the top. Veins popping out of his neck.
Yes.
Cartoonishly chewing up the scenery in every single scene that he's in.
Yep.
He's like on the whole time. And for the most part, I feel like it works.
I thought it did too.
You know, he's the exact opposite of Hannibal. He's like Hannibal Lecter in his character design, except emotionally the exact opposite. Whereas Lecter was very smooth and sort of calculated, he's completely over the top and psychotic.
Yep.
And so he's going to use his DNA. What's interesting is that you end up having the final showdown where Judge Dredd shows back up and him and Rico face off and stuff like that. But this was an area of the movie that there was stuff cut from, because what you start to get to see when Dredd shows up is that the clones are almost ready.
Mm-hmm.
They're like three quarters of the way cooked and they kind of look like white zombies.
Yeah.
You know? There was supposed to be, my understanding is, a sequence where they actually revived and they were going to have to fight these like zombie clones. And all you really see is kind of the waking up of a couple of them, but not really any significant stuff there. And so that was kind of something that got cut out of the movie. And so, of course, you know, you get the final showdown between Dredd and Rico. Hershey ends up fighting against the assistant, whose name is, and I wish I had that here. Her name is Joan Chen, plays Dr. Ilsa Hayden. So those two kind of face off against one another, and then you have Dredd facing off against Rico. Dredd pursues Rico to the top of the Statue of Liberty, and the final struggle sends Rico falling to his death. And so once Rico is dead and Judge Dredd has kind of saved the day, all of these people who thought he was a serial killer 5 minutes ago are back and saying, mm-hmm. Oh, Judge Dredd, you're amazing again. Hey, we want you to be the chief judge from now on. And Judge Dredd says, nope, I'm late for duty. I'm going to throw my armor back on and I'm going to go out and do my patrol. And what's weird is I thought he was going to say, Judge Hershey should be the lead judge.
Yeah.
He doesn't even care.
No.
He's like, I'm going out to do my job. Take care. She gives him a kiss before he goes out and the crowd cheers as he drives off back out into the city to fight more crime.
Yep.
And that's basically how Judge Dredd ends. So overall, I find the movie to be pretty entertaining.
And the thing is, I think that you and I are going to be seeing, and if everybody who's reading these 2000 ADs, if you're reading these 2000 ADs, a lot of this movie makes sense. The pacings, the over-the-top comments, the did that really just happen stupidity, all those things that happen that we love about these stories are in this movie. I mean, to me, the weak parts of the movie are when it becomes a Sylvester Stallone movie or a Rob Schneider movie. Other than that, I think this movie's – I just love it. I've always loved it.
This movie, although it does not directly take – from the stories that we have read so far mm-hmm. or may read in the future, It features pieces of about four different stories.
Yes.
Number one is the return of Rico, which we already read.
Yep.
Rico was the guy who came back. Remember, he was calling himself Judge Dredd, who came back. He was another clone. And he ended up dying in Judge Dredd's arms. And he was imprisoned on Titan.
Yep.
So a lot of the Rico story is from the Rico story. The whole back end of the project in with the judges and stuff, not so much. Mm-hmm. But that piece was there. The Cursed Earth. This is where a bunch of judges went across the Cursed Earth. And then there was a story called The Day the Law Died, which is where the tyrannical and insane Judge Cal, head of the Special Judicial Squad, arranges the assassination of the chief judge and assumes the title himself. This is a loose adaptation of that because you have Judge Griffin, who basically orchestrates the killing of the reporter, the framing of Judge Dredd, and then the retirement of Judge Fargo.
And in the comics, Judge Griffin, I don't think had a seat in power. I think he was just a street judge. And then, an eye patch. He looked like Nick Fury.
The Judge Child is also a story that ties into this that involves the Angel Gang.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's bits and pieces of different stories that were brought in to kind of weave into the overall narrative of this story. So there's a lot of nods to that stuff. Like I said, I thought the special effects overall were good, except for that flying sequence with the bike later on. My biggest problem with this movie is one of tone. And I think that's where, when you read some of the history behind it, you can see that tug of war happening. Because you can see where some of the dialogue was rewritten to be more cheesy. Like, how many times in the movie did Judge Dredd say, "I knew you were going to say that"?
That was, yeah, that was his, that became,
that became his catch line.
That was, yeah, absolutely.
Which, again, was so cheesy every single time he said it.
Yep.
Because it was like, wah, wah.
Yeah, he said it to Schneider two or three times.
He said it to the criminal. Yeah, like, you know, that kind of stuff.
I knew you were going
to
say that.
Oh, please.
But,
no.
But even the way it was delivered was just like eye rolling in the way he delivered it. Rob Schneider definitely was overused to comedic. Rob Schneider just played Rob Schneider after about 15 minutes into this movie.
Yes.
Up until the part where he got to his apartment and ran into the first group of criminals, he was the everyman character.
Yeah.
Then he became Rob Schneider for the rest of the movie.
When he was making fun of him, like, "Oh, Judge Dredd, I'm the law."
Yeah. Just like all of that is awful.
Yep.
And should have been cut from the movie. It was all awful. So that's my problem with the movie. The plot line to me is the plot of every 80s action movie ever, and I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
It was a simple plot, but almost every story we've read so far in the Judge Dredd case files is a very simple plot.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that someone frames Judge Dredd to get both Judge Dredd and the head judge out of power, and it happens to be a clone of him, all that checks out.
Yeah.
Like, I'm down with all of that. Mm-hmm. That doesn't bother me at all. That storyline works perfectly for me. I thought Judge Hershey was underutilized greatly in the movie. So I would like to have seen her have a stronger role other than just to be the person who is kind of there for Judge Dredd to play off of. You know what I mean? But yeah, I mean, tone is really where the movie falls apart for me. The tone of the movie gets too humorous and too cheesy in places where you had the flashes of something that could have been much better, and it just didn't. And so I think ultimately it feels disjointed, and it feels disjointed because it was disjointed because you had this tug of war going on over the production of the movie, and it didn't end up being anything. It didn't end up being something that Stallone was totally happy with, and it didn't end up being something that the writers and the director were happy with. And so ultimately that's the problem, right? You have to at least stick to someone's vision, or else you're going to end up with something that makes nobody happy. And that's kind of what this came out to be. But in the pantheon of 80s action movies, I mean, it's par for the course, right?
Yeah, I
mean,
I don't think this is any worse than Demolition Man.
Right.
I think you can watch both those together.
I feel like Demolition Man is tighter. You know what I mean? And I feel like Wesley Snipes is way ahead of Armando Sante. But certainly, I mean, Demolition Man with the whole Sandra Bullock stuff and the three shells and all that nonsense. Yeah. Terrible. Terrible, terrible, terrible. But Demolition Man still is a super fun movie. But when you look at that, when you look at this feels very much like the Joel Schumacher Batman and Robin type stuff.
You can tell with by Mr. the colors, Freeze, the
with
heights.
Arnold Schwarzenegger. Yeah, yeah, the neon stuff and things like that. So there are some very cheesy elements of it that, again, the movie was trying to be a nod to the comic books. And in some ways, you can see how that might result in leaning in that direction. But I think it had more to do with the more comedic tone that they were trying to create for the movie, which just didn't really work that well.
And what about the intro with the different comics?
Oh, sure. Awesome, I love right? that. Totally yep. awesome. And just the titling and stuff and the fonts and stuff like that. So, I mean, there are – I guess what I'm trying to say is I know you really liked it.
Yep.
I had bad memories of this movie and went back and watched it. And my takeaway from it was, huh, that was better than I thought that it was. And – I'm kind of in a better place with it now than I was when I first watched it the first time around. Yeah. And that was before I even knew anything about Judge Dredd. So I'm interested to think to hear what people have to think. I suspect we're going to have people comment on it that did not rewatch it and only have bad memories of it and will take a big poop on it. But I'm interested to hear whether or not there are people who watched it again and found something more to enjoy in it, watched it again and liked it even less, or really like it from the get-go.
I need to go out and find the Blu-ray. I thought I had it on Blu-ray, but I don't.
I watch it on Netflix. It's on Netflix right now. So there you go. That is your summer watching project entry on Judge Dredd. Let us know what you thought of Judge Dredd. The next one we're going to watch is the animated series, but we're not going to do that for probably another month or so. So we're going to get back to your reading project. And as I mentioned last time, your reading project, your assignment, your homework, if you will, if I can find it somewhere in here, here it is to read from the Don Uggie story with the gorillas. Through the Fuzzy story. That's what you're going to read next time in the case files for your summer reading project. So that is going to wrap up this episode of the Secret Identity Podcast. So for Mr. Matthew A. Herring, this is Brian Lett Henry signing off. Have a great rest of your week, and we will talk to you in a few short days.
Bye-bye.
The rest of the comic publishing world may finally be arriving to the party, but Drive-Thru Comics is the one that started it all. The first downloadable comic shop is still leading the way when it comes to digital comics. Featuring hundreds of publishers, excellent prices, and top-notch customer service, Drive-Thru is a great experience all around. Another thing that sets Drive-Thru apart from a lot of other digital comics platforms is this. When you buy a comic, you own it. You get a watermarked PDF file that you can read on your laptop, your tablet, phone, or any other device. You choose how you enjoy the comics you buy. So head over to drivethroughcomics.com today, and on your way to checking out, download a free issue of Secret Identity.